Welcome to the weekly Dharma Talk podcast from the Columbus Karma Taksim Choling Buddhist Meditation Center. This week's talk is entitled, Taking Care of the Child of Our Mind, Our Buddha Nature. The Buddha taught that all beings possess the potential for spiritual awakening, and as such, all are worthy of care and respect. But sometimes we act against our own best interests and engage in holding negative attitudes toward ourselves and others. Lama Kathy describes traditional teachings about Buddha nature and then offers an analogy that our Buddha nature is like our most precious child to help us take a more positive attitude toward ourselves and our potential. If you like our Dharma Talk series, please consider donating to Columbus Karma Taksim Choling at columbusktc.org. Enjoy the podcast.
Well, I'm happy to be here today. I apologize that there was no topic given for today's talk. I've just been too busy to do the right thing, which is to make plans in advance for what I'm going to talk about. This week, a couple of things happened, and I thought that it might be worthwhile to discuss them. I had a couple of conversations with people this week that also revealed some possible topics to discuss this week. And so I think that's how I'm going to begin. We'll start with the short refuge prayer. If this is a prayer that you already know, that you're already familiar with, you can join in. And if it's a prayer with which you're unfamiliar, you can join in your heart and in your mind, thinking that you dedicate this session of study to the benefit of all sentient beings. I'll recite the prayer three times. Ho sanje chedang so ji cho nam la jang chu par du dan ni kyap su chi Da ji jin so ji bei se nam ki dro la pen shi san je dru par sho san je che dang so ji cho nam la Jang chu par du dan ni kyap su chi Da ji jin so ji bei su nam ki Dro la pen shi san je dru par sho Sanje chidang so ji cho nam la Jang chu par du dan ni kyap su chi Da ji jin so ji bei su nam ki Dro la pen shi san je dru par sho. O palin sa we lama rinpo che tagi chi or pe de ten shi la kajin jenpo kone che sun te Kusum tugging a drip south to soul. Okay, thank you. Once again, welcome and thanks for being here. Yeah, I'm sorry it's a little chilly in here today. I apologize. We have two temperatures in this room. One is extremely hot and the other is rather cold. It's just one of the glories of being in an older building. It's really hard to find that middle way of balance between the extremes, but I guess that's the goal for us. In any case, I know that it's already been introduced that we have these beautiful opening prayers and closing prayers for the shamatha practice, but I wanted to just say thanks again Kim and the board of KTC for approving these beautiful prayer sheets, and to Justin and his team for making them. It was brought to our attention that we are homeless. I don't know if if you've noticed, but we're living in God's basement right now. As a way of pulling together the resources, the money, and the merit that we need to relocate. And someone pointed out to us that we are missing some opportunities to dedicate merit and goodness toward the benefit of all sentient beings, because the Buddha said we are what we think. All that we are arises with our thoughts. And with our thoughts, we make the world. And so if we want to create a situation of virtue in this world, we have to create virtue within our own minds. And this means that if our minds are full of our busy mundane things like protecting friends, subduing enemies, doing all of these things that we feel we need to do in order to survive in this mundane world, if our minds are busy with that, it's harder to practice Dharma. It's harder to do good things when your mind is always absorbed with the minutiae of our mundane world. And therefore, we're encouraged to practice virtue as much as possible, which includes holding a virtuous state of mind. And so the person who suggested that we do this said that it would be great if we could create some virtue before we have our sitting meditation, and also dedicate that virtue at the end so that we're not keeping it for ourselves, but rather dedicating it to everyone. So that is why we started with this lovely opening prayer of aspiration, which is called the Prayer of the Four Immeasurables. May all beings be happy and have the causes of happiness. It's not just may they be happy, but may they actually have the causes of happiness. And by this, we're talking about what the Buddha taught is the cause of happiness, which is virtuous mind and virtuous actions, kindness toward oneself, kindness toward others, and so forth. And then the second line is, may they be free from suffering and the causes of suffering, which according to the Buddha's teaching, the causes of suffering are self-clinging, grasping, and all of the negative mental afflictions such as anger, jealousy, and the rest. And so if we abandon these causes of suffering and embrace these causes of happiness, then it is more likely that we will be able to carry out the third verse, which is, may they never be cut off from the highest bliss, which is devoid of suffering. And by this, they're not talking about some sort of pie in the sky happiness. They're talking about the happiness that comes from being even-minded and balanced in one's temperament, neither remaining in a state of isolation away from beings and having no compassion for beings, but neither being completely enmeshed in worldly mundane things. So may they never be separate from the highest bliss, which is the awakened state of mind, which is the mind that has happiness and its causes and avoids suffering and its causes. And then may they dwell in great equanimity, free of attachment and aversion. And so when Kempo Carter Rinpoche teaches this prayer, he teaches it from the back end front, toward the front. He says, if we have equanimity, if we cultivate a sense of equanimity, then it's easier to practice goodness toward others and to avoid harming others. If we recognize that everybody's just like us and they hurt the way we hurt and they feel the way we feel, if we recognize that others are like us, we will be less likely to harm them and more likely to help them. And so he says, starting from this point of reminding ourselves of equanimity, then it's easy to avoid harming beings which is the cause of suffering. And it's easy to practice virtue toward beings, which is the cause of happiness. And living this way brings joy. So that's a short statement of the four immeasurables from the point of view of Kempo Carter Rinpoche. When he was teaching this to us so long ago, he said, you start with equanimity, that everybody's like you and wants the things that you want and doesn't want the things that you don't want. So you make your life about not harming them and not giving them the things they hate and not doing things to them that are harmful. And on the other hand, doing things that are helpful, both toward yourself and toward others. And so this is basically the Buddhist teaching. So if anybody comes up to you and says, what do Buddhists believe in and what do Buddhists do and how do they practice? You can tell them that basic quotation, we are what we think, all that we are arises with our thoughts, and with our thoughts we make the world. That's what Buddhists believe. And what do Buddhists do? We practice the four statements of the Buddha. Do no harm, practice virtue, tame your mind. This is the Buddha's teaching in its entirety. And so I think a lot of people feel a little, anxious when somebody asks them to explain Buddhism, because Buddhism is so big. How could you possibly explain it? But those two things really help the most. We are what we think. All that we are arises with our thoughts. With our thoughts, we make the world. And do no harm, practice virtue, tame your mind. And so hopefully this will help you as you approach this week, meeting your family members over Thanksgiving dinner. And they say, what is this Buddhism thing you're doing anyhow? Because it could come up in casual conversation. It might not, but it might come up in casual conversation if you tell them that you're meditating or that you've been practicing meditation. They'll say, well, what's that about? Why would you practice meditation? It's because we are what we think. Are you guys with it? What's the next one? We are what we think. All that we are arises with our thoughts, and with our thoughts, we make the world. Okay, you're getting it. Okay. What's the first one of the four teachings of the Buddha? Do no harm. Second one, practice virtue. Third one, tame your mind. Fourth one, this is the practice of the Buddha, or this is the teaching of the Buddha, meaning there is no other. Don't look any farther. This is it. So now you're ready for Thanksgiving dinner. We try to perform all good services here. Thank you. Yeah, no problem. No, thank you. No, thank you. So I'm going to have a hard time describing this for you, Dawn. But I think we're going to start by calling it. I've taught on the. This is only the first part. This is only the first part. Four immeasurables, but it'll have a different title. Okay. The reason I wanted to mention this is because we are coming up on one of the more difficult times of the year when we have to sit with people we haven't seen for a while and sit with people, members of our family, with whom we might have a complicated relationship. Let's just put it that way. It's complex. Our relationship with our family members might be complex. And as such, we might have some difficult feelings toward them. And one of the things that you can do when you are feeling complicated toward a family member, one of the things you can do is you can imagine that they are being blessed while you're sitting with them. And I have tried this and it helps me, so maybe it will help you. If you are coming in contact with someone that you are feeling complex about or have complex feelings toward, it would be really lovely if you could imagine that the Buddha, Shakyamuni, made of golden light, descends upon them and blesses them. That way you don't have to worry too much about trying to fix them or convince them of anything, which are two problems that can happen when we are with people with whom we have a complex relationship. Sometimes when we have complex feelings about people, we kind of want to fix them or make them think differently. But really, what we could do instead is merely send love and compassion their way. Imagine the Buddha dissolves into them, and that is a blessing to them. Because if we can do that, it's a blessing to us. Why? Because every moment we spend blessing them. We will not be thinking badly of them. We will not be turning that grudge over in our minds. Why do they treat me this way? Why can't they see who I am? Why can't they appreciate me? Why don't they like me? Because when we think thoughts like that, then our resentment for them grows. And as my friends in 12-step always say, when you are nursing a grudge or a resentment, it's like drinking something poisonous and expecting the other person to get sick. The resentment harms us, and so we have to be very careful about that. So you can imagine the Buddha Shakyamuni or the beautiful Bodhisattva Tara dissolving into your relatives, or the medicine Buddha, blue in color, or Chenrezig, the Bodhisattva of compassion, dissolving into your loved ones, especially the ones you have complicated feelings toward. And hopefully this will be of help to you. So that's a little bit of an introduction for today's talk. Today I'm going to talk briefly about a topic I've discussed before, but I don't know. I've talked to several people this week, and none of them are here. These are Dharma friends that I have telephone calls with. And I have telephone calls with Dharma friends weekly. And I answer their Dharma questions and so forth. If this is something that interests you, you can write to mail, M-A-I-L, at Lama Kathy, LamaKathy.net, and talk to Pam, and she can set up a time for you to chat. But I was talking to several people this week, and it seemed that the theme that was repeating was the theme of not caring about oneself or having complicated feelings about oneself. It's not complicated feelings about your relatives. It's complicated feelings about yourself. In other words, sometimes we don't like ourselves very much. Sometimes we get mad at ourselves for what we have done, who we have been, or even who we are right this minute. We get to feeling complicated about all of it. And we may actually feel badly about ourselves and think that we're not a good person. Or we might think that the world is not a good world, which, hint, hint, if we think the world is not a good world, it kind of starts from within us. So if you're feeling judgmental about the world and think the world is a terrible place where there's a lot of bad people, it's because we've got kind of we're kind of stuck in a rut of thinking negatively, period, but also possibly feeling bad about ourselves, possibly. Your mileage may vary, but let's see. Sometimes people say to me, I'm not a good person, or they'll say, I'm not worthy. Or they will say, Dharma meditation isn't working for me, and it's because there's something wrong with me, and so forth and so on. But really, what it comes down to is that we have not really looked at our situation fully and completely. If we look at our situation fully and completely, we will see that there is actually great promise here. And so this is a talk about Buddha nature. I like to talk about it from time to time, letting people know that they all have Buddha potential, which is very interesting because that means this world as a whole has potential because there are so many people in it that have the potential to awaken and become an enlightened being. So that means our whole world has potential. Now, not that we're using it, and not that the world is making use of it, but that we need to protect ourselves and protect the world in order to get into a space where we can actually make use of all the riches that we have. And so I sometimes talk about Buddha nature from a spiritual point of view. The Buddha taught that all of us have a mind. You have one, I have one. Most of the time we use it to solve problems. What do they say? Subdue enemies, protect friends, and all of those mundane things, make money. We use it to have a life and make money and do all of those things. But often the mind, it kind of goes to waste a little bit because we sit and worry and go around in a circle and around in a circle and around in a circle. But the Buddha's teaching is that our mind is not a solid object. It's not made of atoms or molecules. Our mind is actually, the way you could say it is that it is a cognitive lucidity. Or you could say that the mind has the capability of knowing, K-N-O-W-I-N-G. It can know things. Even though it's not made of atoms or molecules, it can know things. It can experience things. We're experiencing this room right now. Some of us are bundled up because it's so cold in here. Others are thinking about this or that, and so their worldview is slightly different right now. The fact of the matter is, we have a mind that can experience and can know. But one of the things it can know is itself. It can actually know itself. And we know our minds in kind of a tangential way, in that we know our thoughts. Some of the times we know our thoughts, and some of the times we know our feelings, and some of the times we know the stories that we tell ourselves about our lives. These are things we know so far. This is what we know so far. And we know our thoughts, our feelings, and our emotions. We know them, but we don't know where they come from. And we don't really know what our mind is really like in the absence of thought or emotion or feeling or sensation. We don't really know what mind is like at its base, at its root, because we keep our minds very busy. We may keep our minds busy with our daily lives. We might keep our minds busy with the dramas of our family. We may keep our minds busy with the dramas of our politics. We may keep our minds busy with the drama of the world. But whatever we're keeping our mind busy with, we're not paying attention to the mind itself. We're only watching the manifestations of the mind, like a person who's watching the ocean and only sees the waves on top and doesn't know what's beneath the waves on top of the ocean. But when we start meditating, we begin to get a sense that there's more to our minds than just our thoughts and the stories. Because in meditation, we let go of the thoughts and we just rest the mind in itself. Short periods of time at first, and then a little more and a little more and a little more. And then we can actually see that there's more to our mind than the stories we tell ourselves about what's happening. That there's actually a depth to our mind and a placidness and a peacefulness that may only last for 1 second on our meditation seat, or 2 seconds on our meditation seat. But because we've experienced that 1 second, 2 seconds, 3 seconds of peacefulness, we know there's more where that came from. And we're inspired to look for it. And so this is, you could say, the work of the meditator is to begin to uncover mind's basic nature. And this is why the Buddha taught in his 3 turnings of the wheel of Dharma different ways of looking at the mind. In the first turning of the wheel of Dharma, he asked his followers to consider that it's possible that our mind is not our self-concept, that our self-concept is not who we really are, that the concept is made of thoughts, and those thoughts are impermanent and can actually cease. And in the moment that those thoughts have ceased, our self-grasping and our self-concept falls apart, which should be a piece of insight and another reason why we're just like everybody else. We grasp at things that are not there and defend them against everyone. In the second turning of the wheel of Dharma, the Buddha taught that our self-concept was empty of reality. But he also said that all things are that way, which I guess if you study science, you know how that works. Everything is made of atoms and molecules according to science. And in between all of them is lots and lots of space. And that actually all the atoms and molecules in the world are slowly falling apart. Second law of thermodynamics, everything falls apart. So the Buddha said that's how it is. He didn't quote physics. He just quoted his experience of his own mind as being something always changing, always in flux, and not established. And then finally, in the third turning of the wheel of Dharma, he said that the mind not only wasn't the same as self-concept, that's the first turning of the wheel, he also didn't say it was completely empty void, he didn't say that. In the third turning of the wheel, he said the mind is, it has this spontaneous presence of this knowing quality. And he called it luminosity or clarity, that mind actually is spontaneously and always present. And as a result, it's not a thing, but it's not nothing, because it has this knowing and experiential quality that is its spontaneous presence of Buddha nature. So that's the sort of spiritual class part of today's lecture. Just quoting what the Buddha said about our mind. Now we come to the sort of crux of the matter, which is, if this is our potential, if this is our mind, I guess we better do something about it. Kempo Carter Rinpoche, when he first taught us about Buddha nature so many years ago, he said, your mind has a quality to it. And I think one of my Dharma friends who is here uses it as his signature line on his email. So I'm going to have to look up an email from you and then check this line out, because I quote it because it was Kempo Carter Rinpoche's statement. He said, I have to go down to the bottom, we all have a spark of goodness. 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 I have to repeat that. We all have a spark of goodness. Oh, yes, it's a spark, but it's goodness. We have a spark of goodness in us, a powerful potential for developing warmth, openness, tenderness, sanity, and an incomparable sense of well-being and richness that cannot be approached by material or physical wealth and comfort. In other words, this is what you might call the good news of Buddhism, that we all have this basic nature which can be uncovered. It can be uncovered through our practice of meditation and our practice of embracing that which causes happiness and discarding that which causes suffering. Or as Kempo Rinpoche says, embracing what is genuine, discarding what is not worthwhile. And so the reason I like to quote this over and over again was that this lecture was a turning point in my life. I was present when he said this. And it was at a Columbus KTC gathering, a lot smaller than this. And he wanted us to know we had Buddha nature so that we would know that even if we have bad feelings about ourselves from time to time, or think we are hopeless in our habits and our bad habits, that in spite of all of that, we still have the potential to be a Buddha, because that spark of goodness is our Buddha nature and mind's potential to know itself and to know itself completely. Of course, leaving that lecture, I was both made happy by the fact that I had Buddha nature, which means you and you and you and you and you and you and you. All of you have Buddha nature. This, nobody's left out. I'm not leaving anybody out today. Everybody here has Buddha nature. But when I left that lecture, I was a little bit scared because, oh my gosh, I have Buddha nature. That means I have to do something about it. I can't just let it be a potential that somebody told me that I should believe in. Darn it. You mean I actually have to do something with this now? For a long time, I carried that as a very heavy responsibility that was almost too much to carry. What, you mean they're expecting me to become a Buddha? Oh my gosh, it's impossible. I have so many bad habits. But you have Buddha nature. But my bad habits. But you have Buddha nature. So you can see the conversation that goes on. So we have to have an intermediary between these two arguing factions in our mind. you have Buddha nature. But I have so many bad habits. We have to have some kind of a person to make peace in this. And so the example that I made up for this is I am encouraging everybody these days to take care of the child of their mind. Take care of the child that is their mind. I made this example up because I know so many people who have children or who have younger brothers and sisters or who have nieces and nephews they care about or younger members of their friends' families that they care about. And these young people have such potential, and we want them to feel cared for and feel loved so that they will be able to feel happiness and goodness in their lives. And so it is that I'm encouraging people to think of their Buddha nature as though it were their most precious child. We might sort of badmouth ourselves from time to time, but what if we thought of ourselves as a child, our own child, and that we decided, we made the decision that we were going to give the child of our mind every advantage, just like we would our human children or our animal children or our friends' children or our own relatives' children. We would want them to have every advantage. We would want them to have every goodness. We would want them to have every opportunity and to feel encouraged. We wouldn't want those children to feel discouraged. We wouldn't want them to feel uncared for. We would give them things, give them gifts that they could use. We would give them things that they would be able to use in the future to help themselves feel better. Little babies, yes, we would give them a teddy bear or something to help them stay accompanied in their lives. I sometimes feel that toys are accompaniment. There's something to accompany us through our childhood and our youth. And that is why when we think of our childhood toys, we feel a little sentimental because they were our first friends, the first friends who never left us. They never left us. Of course, if we left them on the bus, yes, they left us, but eventually we would get someone who was there for us again. So the idea here is if we can look at our Buddha nature as this potential and take good care of it, this would be excellent. That way, we would feel inspired to get on our meditation seat every day. Yes, every day, because I have to give my child these tutoring lessons in how to be human. That's what meditation is. They're like little tutoring sessions in how to be a genuine, decent human being. Because following our thoughts here, there, and everywhere, it turns us into wild children. But using the taming mechanism of meditation, always bringing our attention back to the object of meditation again and again with gentleness, because we are our own precious child, bringing our attention back gently without judgment. Yes, I'm coming back. Yes, I'm coming back again and again. Practicing this gentility toward the child of our mind, we gradually learn how to stand on our own two feet and make decisions about things that are important. Like these days, there's a meme I've seen on Twitter where somebody says something and then they say, "Don't say it, don't say it, don't say it," and then they blurt out whatever they were thinking. It's a meme. It's a joke. It's funny because we all have these things inside ourselves that we want to say but don't say. But making a good decision is really not saying it. It's actually really not saying it. And holding one's child of one's mind in a precious embrace and caring for that child, it means reciting mantras when you are doing nothing. Driving your car, waiting in line, you can recite Om Mani Padme Hum, the compassion mantra of Chenrezig, while waiting and doing nothing, because that's creating a virtuous atmosphere in your mind. So the child of your mind has something pleasant on the music in their heads. And when we see other people, we know that they are taking care of the child of their mind too. And we recognize that their child may not be as disciplined as our child, but they're still loved and they're still wonderful and they still have great potential. And we develop compassion for those other people whose mind children, the child of their mind, has not been treated well, has not had every advantage, and so forth. We can even do that wonderful thing called accumulating virtuous mind states or accumulating merit. Because just as we would want to save money to send our human child to college, we would want to save up merit to send the child of our mind to the pure realms of happiness and Buddhahood. So we want to plan for that child's future life. When I was new in Buddhism, Kempo Karta Rinpoche said to me, you have to practice for your future life. You can't necessarily just practice and expect something wonderful to happen in your current life. You have to practice for your future life. And I couldn't understand that. I didn't really understand that. But once I came up with the image of the child of one's mind, it's like, I'm going to be somebody in the future. Wouldn't I want that child that I am going to be to have every advantage? Wouldn't I want the child of my mind to be positive and to use their incredible power for good, for the power of good? So I made up this example of the child of one's mind. And so I am going to hand this example to you and ask you to work with it in the next week or so, because you might be running into some children in the upcoming weeks as all of the various holidays cycle through. And this way, you can appreciate your own child of your own mind and start saying nice things to the child of your mind. Instead of saying bad things to yourself like, why are you not getting this? Why are you so imperfect? And so forth and so on. Rather than practicing any kind of punishment or cruelty toward the child of your mind, why not say, I cherish you, child of my mind. May you do no harm. May you practice virtue and may you tame your mind, because this is the teaching of the Buddha. And try always to consider the potential that you have, your Buddha nature, and give yourself an opportunity to practice, to nurture that and uncover that Buddha nature. So that was what I wanted to talk about today, the child of one's mind. Now, I'm stopping a little early today because I thought that this is a kind of a difficult concept to talk about Buddha nature. Not everybody can relate to it. So I thought I would spend the first part of the lecture talking about the philosophy of Buddha nature, all that emptiness stuff, and then talk the second half about what I feel is the more concrete example of the child of our mind. So you can ask about any part of this, or you can ask a different question. The microphone is open for you. So we have the question mic. If you have anything you'd like to ask about, feel free to go and ask. And if the child of your mind has a question, you can let them ask too.
Hello, everyone.
Hello.
Thank you, Lama Kathy, for your teaching today. Mm-hmm. I have a question, I guess, about the Buddha nature in terms of, is this Buddha nature connecting us all? Like through Buddha nature, I mean, I guess right. My question is, yeah. Are we still connected to the Buddha through Buddha nature? That's my question.
That's the first question, right? Okay. First question is, we all have Buddha nature, all of us. Nobody lacks Buddha nature. In fact, you could even say that the dust mites, the insects in the carpet, they have Buddha nature. They can't do very much with it, but they have it. You know, so, and does the Buddha nature, the fact that we all have Buddha nature, connect us to each other? And the answer to that is yes. It's not that we are all part of one big mind, because there are some philosophers or people who study philosophy who theorize that we're all part of one big mind. But that's not the case according to the teaching of the Buddha. The Buddha said we're all individual minds. But because our nature is the same, when we experience Buddhahood through the practice of meditation, the experience of Buddhahood is the same for everyone. Then because of their individual karma, our individual karma and habits that are purified through Buddhahood, our manifestations as Buddhas and Bodhisattvas will appear differently, okay? But we will all experience our minds the same way. How we express that and how we teach that to others and benefit others will be individual to us. Does that make sense? And then one more thing to say, and then I'll get to the last part of your question. The fact that we all have Buddha nature connects us to each other in that we all have the potential, and then we can all sort of feel encouragement for one another. I can encourage you to uncover your Buddha nature, and you, and you, and you, and you, and you. We're not all part of one big mind. The proof of this, according to a Buddhist scholar that I spoke to, you know Kenpo Urgyen Tenzin, the one of the Kenpos at KTD Monastery. I asked him this question. I said, are we all part of one big mind? And he said, this was not the Buddhist teaching. He said, we are all individuals. He said, the reason, the proof that the Buddha gave was that if we were all part of one big mind, then when the Buddha gained Buddhahood, everyone would have gained Buddhahood. Because, so unfortunately, we all have to do it individually. Okay, but what this also means, though, is that we are connected to the Buddha Shakyamuni in that he also had Buddha nature. An interesting story. Sitta Rinpoche said once that we have the same amount of Buddha nature as the Buddha Shakyamuni. It's not that he had extra Buddha nature. It wasn't like that. He had just the same amount of Buddha nature as we have. It's just that he was able to uncover his, and ours is still covered. So yes, we are still connected because the Buddha didn't disappear when he died. No enlightened being disappears. They actually, because that would mean that your mind was something that was created by someone and could go out of existence. Because if it's created, it'll fall apart. But if it's uncreated, never been created, it never ends. Therefore, the Buddha taught that our mind is continuous from no beginning of time to the no ending of time. So that connects us to each other and to the Buddha. Does that answer the question, or is there more?
It's perfect. Thank you, Lama Geshe.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, thank you. Yeah. Yes. By the way, I like that shirt. What is this one? It's a Beat Michigan shirt. Michigan. That's right. There's more than just Thanksgiving happening this week.
Yes, there is.
For some people in some people's homes, this is also Thanksgiving.
Yes.
But it's mainly Beat Michigan week. Yeah. Okay, yeah.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Is doing an empowerment like white Tara, green Tara, is that considered meditation?
Mm-hmm. The question is receiving an empowerment the same as meditation? It is, because what happens in an empowerment is that a master who has done a certain amount of meditation on that Buddha or on that Bodhisattva meditates upon themselves as being that Buddha or Bodhisattva, meditates on all of their implements, a vajra or a bell or a flower or a mala or whatever, as being embodiments of that Buddha or Bodhisattva, and then uses those things to encourage the recipient of the empowerment to meditate that their minds and speech and body are being purified, and that they are then blessed with the presence of that Buddha or Bodhisattva by the master. The master basically hands them, the master gives them the deity or the Buddha or Bodhisattva through this meditation that they do. And at the conclusion, near the conclusion, of the empowerment, the meditating, the master who's giving the empowerment invites, it meditates upon the nature of mind, their own mind, and invites everybody else in the room to do the same thing. So in a way, an empowerment is a form of guided meditation that is different than the guided meditation that we do on a daily basis if we then practice white tara or green tara or chenrezig. Does that make sense? We use different texts, but the empowerment text is a different text. But it's a guided meditation both for the master and for the disciple so that there can be a connection between the master, the disciple, and the Buddha. Does that? They're like opening the curtain of our confusion just a little bit to say, excuse me, you're a Buddha. Shh, it's okay. And then close it. Yeah. And then closes, and then encourages us to meditate like that. So it's, yeah. Okay, thank you. Other questions that people might have? Yeah, sure.
Since everyone has Buddha nature,
Maybe get a little closer.
Can you hear me?
There we go.
All right. Does it matter how a person obtains enlightenment or how they learn about Buddha nature?
I'm going to repeat for the recording. If everyone has Buddha nature, does it make a difference how they encounter or told about Buddha nature or how they uncover it, right? Does it make a difference? Is that what you're...
Do the means or methods by which they learn about Buddha nature matter?
Do the means that they learn about Buddha nature matter? Yeah, it is actually sort of important. The reason being is that... If you meet a Buddhist master, and the Buddhist master basically takes you under their wing and says, I will teach you how to see your Buddha nature, and they will tell you that you have Buddha nature, then there's, it's like the example of a flower in a flower pot. You have soil in the flower pot, and then your Buddha nature is like the seed that you put in the flower pot, right? And so if you have the blessing of a master who is teaching you, then it's as though you're putting extra nutrients on the plant so it will grow more rapidly. You could also find out about Buddha nature by reading a book, and that would also be a blessing. It may or may not be the same because the book may not be able to nurture you and to help you avoid mistakes, because books may or may not be able to tell you your mistakes, but a teacher definitely will. So that's the second. And then the third thing is if you learn about Buddha nature from doing your own style that you made up of meditation, you might not know what to do with it at all. It might be an inspiration, but you might not be able to do anything with it. Does that?
What about in a time when, if there aren't teachers available and there aren't books, by life experience, someone that would learn about it from
What you're talking about actually does happen, because the Buddha taught that the teaching of there are going to be 1,000 Buddhas in this era, according to the teachings of the Buddha. So when the teaching of one Buddha slowly dies out, there will be this sort of interregnum, as they call it in history, this intervening period when there's no Buddha. And what will arise during that time are what they call arhats. They are called Shravakas and Pratika Buddhas. The Pratika Buddhas are actually literally called self-made Buddhas, but they only experience an awakening that is within themselves, and it's not a full awakening because they don't have the knowledge. They don't have the teachings that will help them go farther. But they will be sort of, they will see how thoughts, words, and actions create our experience, but they won't have the full experience of freedom from clinging to the peace of meditation. They won't have that. But that's all right. In a future life, maybe they will be reborn in a situation where there is Dharma, and then they also won't teach anybody. They won't help anybody else with Dharma. They're self-made, so they don't help. So they might have a lucky experience in the period between. But in this era that we're in right now, We're full of, like, there's lots of Buddhist teachers and lots of Buddhist things, so you don't have to worry about there not being a Buddhist teacher for you personally.
Do you know where you'll find, are there direct writings by the Buddha about what's about differences between that, as in what those...
Yes. Are there different writings that explain the differences between Shravakas, Pratika Buddhas, and Buddhas, right?
Yeah, so you know what's missing between the two.
Yeah, there are. And I will talk with my scholar friends and send me an email and I'll send you the titles of the books. But yeah, there are books that describe the differences. But the main difference is that because the Shravakas and the Pratika Buddhas are not fully enlightened Buddhas, they cling to the state of mental peace that they get when they meditate, and they can't let go of it. And so they think that that's the absolute, when the absolute is being able to let go of that. That's the main difference.
Are there instructions on how to know that there are? Are there instructions, meditation techniques, and other behavioral techniques to let you know?
I'm really curious. Are you thinking that you're going to become a Pratika Buddha? Is that maybe what you're thinking, or
no? But
you just want to study it so you can become one, or
I want to be able to know as a checklist-based thing of knowing what they actually are.
Oh, I see. So you've met people who've claimed to be a Buddha.
I have met people that do meditation practices, and it seems like if you could create an actual step roadmap, you could actually arrange them in order to know which is which.
Uh-huh. I think I understand your question, and yes, there are textbooks. I can only speak to this tradition because this is the one I know the best, but there are textbooks that go step by step by step by step in teaching you how to meditate, how to avoid the pitfalls, and how to benefit your practice. There are textbooks. But it's better to study those textbooks in the presence of a teacher, and then the teacher can check up on your understanding of it to make sure your understanding is not in error. Does that make sense?
Yes. And for teachers, does a person actually have to know they have a teacher?
They have to what?
Do they actually have to know they have a teacher?
People do have to know that they have a teacher because otherwise they may end up having like an imaginary teacher. Like they think that they're receiving advice from some other place.
You couldn't do something like a Zen koan style teaching method.
I wish I could tell you about Zen. I never learned it. But I can tell you about this tradition. Being self-taught has a pitfall, and that is that we can fool ourselves. Yeah.
You're saying that those books would have they have instructions then?
Yes and no. Some of them are suggestions, but you'd have to talk to a teacher to get the full instruction.
Okay.
Okay, yeah. The next person? Okay, thank you. Yeah, thank you. Yeah. Being self-taught is really good if you're already partially awakened, you know, but being self-taught can be complicated. Yeah. Yeah, so having a teacher will help you avoid, it'll help you get there faster. Because if you go the wrong way, then you end up in like the formless realms and you're there for a long time and you don't become a Buddha. So it's much better.
What are those realms?
They're called the formless realms of the, there are formless realms in the desire realm and it's the formless realms. They're like God realms, and there's no Buddha. You're not a Buddha there. You just kind of hang out. Yeah. So, like I say, if you read the book Dharma Paths, and then there's another book you can read. It won't have those instructions you're looking for, but it'll tell you the framework. And I can give you the names after. Okay. And here's our other questioner. And yes, go ahead.
How does the Kagyu view the Rangtong versus the Shentong controversy? I'm just curious about that.
Yeah, the person is asking about a philosophical argument between two schools of Buddhism. I think they might, are they both Madhyamaka? Help me out,
yes,
guys. Yeah, they're both Madhyamaka, okay. In the Great Middle Way Path, there is a philosophical argument of the Rongtong and the Shentong, and believe it or don't, if I got this right, the Rongtong is the self-empty? And then Rongtong is the other empty. So the answer is, I can't answer it today. What I can tell you is that one teacher, when they explained this to us, they said that one teaches emptiness, and the other basically says emptiness is empty of everything except Buddha nature. And so then the Rongtong people think that the Shentong people are deists because they believe in a God figure, but they don't. Dharmakaya is not God. So the idea of the mind, you know, the mind of awakening being God is, you know. As Kempo Rinpoche once said, if you ask, do Buddhists believe in God? And he said, I'll tell you what. He said, if you think that God is a person who has a personality and lives somewhere and he has likes and dislikes, he says, I wouldn't say we believe in that. But if you believe that that God is the inexpressible nature of all things, then yes, we do believe in that. So there's a wonderful book you can read. And this book is the book you want. The previous questioner was asking for a book. I've got the book for you. It's called Progressive Meditation on the Stages of Emptiness. What is it?
Yes.
Progressive Meditation on the Stages of Emptiness. It explains all of that.
Yes.
Yeah. And
it's
so
skinny and prepare to spend a couple years getting.
Yeah, it will take you at least 2 years. It'll take at least 2 years to both study it and practice everything that's in it.
Yeah.
So, yep.
Thank you.
Yeah, that's exactly the book you need. All right. Yeah, because this will be our last. Oh, sorry?
Okay. Who wrote the book?
It's Kempo Tsultrum Jomso. Thank you for that, because we need that for the recording. GYAMTSO. And first name is Tsultrum, TSULTRIM. Kempo Tsultrum Jomso, and we'll have a conversation about that. Okay, so yeah, that's the book you need.
Okay, so
yeah.
I have
yeah.
two things. One about what we just talked about.
Sure.
And another kind of going back to the beginning with your questions on sort of panpsychism.
Yeah.
So first, with the Shentong view, wouldn't that be positing inherent existence?
In a way, no. In a way, yes, but no. The way it was explained to me is that Buddha nature is called great permanence by the philosophers. And basically what this means is that the mind of an individual was never created. Let's go back there. The mind of an individual was never created. And yet it has the capability to know itself. That non-creation and the knowing of itself is permanent. Is where they, and the fact that that mind is continuous, never stops, never. Mind is continuous and never stops. Yes, we may experience moments of unconsciousness while we are in a human body, but mind is continuous and was never created, never ends, and always has the potential to know itself. And that's why they call it great permanence, the fact that Buddha nature never leaves us. Does that make sense?
Yeah, is it sort of like saying that it's still free from any like conceptual nature? Is that
in its ultimate nature? Yes, Buddha nature is without stain. It's perfect.
Okay.
But because we don't know it, here's the way it was explained to me by Kempo Carter Rinpoche. This is all I know, since I'm not like a brain. You know what I mean? I don't study the books. He said, our mind has always had these two things simultaneously. Mind is limitless, and therefore it possesses all potential, including the potential to not know its own nature. And this potential to not know its own nature, he called it the mere sheen, S-H-E-E-N, the mere sheen, like an oil sheen on a puddle. That mere sheen of ignorance is what has prevented us from seeing our Buddha nature from beginningless time until now. And through the practice of meditation, it's dispelled, and we see our Buddha nature as it is. And so the idea is that Buddha nature cannot be destroyed. It cannot be sullied. It can be covered, but it can't be poisoned. It can't be, you see what I'm saying? It can't be degraded. It's always there. And that's where they got the idea. They call it spontaneous presence. because it's always there. But in an unrealized state, we don't get much good out of it. But when it's realized, that's when it begins to... Yeah. Does that help some?
Yeah, it does.
Awesome.
And then...
We have one more time for one more question, and that's... Yeah?
Did you want to...
Yeah.
Okay. So sort of the other thing I wanted to touch on with the beginning is that you mentioned, like, even going down to the level of, say, mites, for example.
Yeah.
Having Buddha nature.
Yeah.
And then you went on to say that there is no universal mind, however.
Correct.
So the problem I'm sort of running into is that I don't see any irreducible principle at which, like, sentient beings stop being sentient beings. Like, if you go further beyond mites,
yeah,
like, I'm talking even further beyond bacteria.
I know. Viruses.
Yeah. Well, even I guess what the point I'm trying to get at is, even at the level of organization of, like, an individual molecule, there's no hard stopping point at which it's longer life, no longer existence. So,
yeah.
What, like, how could there not be some sort of universal consciousness under this framework? How can there be individual beings when at no level of organization a being really arises?
And I really can't answer that. Just to quote the scholar who said that this was not the teaching of the Buddha. So what we have to do now is find out the reasons that the Buddha gave, the proofs, so to speak, of this theory. I mean, because the Buddha's statement basically was there is no big universal mind and we're not all part of it. But I definitely understand and respect that question, and I honestly do not know the answer. So we would have to ask one of the scholars. And there might be a way to do that. There might be a way to do that. And we might be able to organize an email to one of the scholars and ask them to address it, because I honestly don't know. Because I understand your question about that level of organization, because cells, I mean, what, right?
Right.
I know.
Like, what is sentient?
I know. What is sentient? And I don't know. And did you have an answer for that, actually? Yeah.
I just wonder if, like, the energies kind of wash over each other, and the, you know, your energy and my energy like that.
Oh, I see. Yeah, I see. I wish I knew. I wish I knew, because what you're suggesting is that one of the quote-unquote proofs of this would be that they are very close to one another, but they're still separate. And that's an interesting way of looking at that too. I wish I knew. This is kind of like, you know, in those old-fashioned books when they thought that the Earth was flat, and they said, you know, you go off the end of the Earth and there be dragons, you know, down under this flat Earth. And I get that way with my knowledge sometimes. I get up to a certain point of knowledge and it's like, oh, after that there's dragons, and so we'll have to write. Help. Would you help write out the question? Awesome. Okay. Write out the question and then let's get that organized. My wonderful husband and I—he's so great. I hope you get to meet him someday. He's a very nice man. We've been married for 45 years, and I like to hope that he has rubbed off a little bit of his good humor on me. So anyway, so any of the jokiness you get today came from the two lineages of my humor. I am the coming together of two streams, like Gampopa.
Yeah.
My father's sense of humor and my husband's sense of humor. They've come together and given me the unusual sense of humor I have today. So anyway, thank you, Kim. Thank you, and all the team. Yay, team.
So you're going to write the jewel ornament of humor liberation.
Of humor, yes. I'll write the jewel ornament of humor liberation.
There you go.
Yeah. Well, let's sit quietly and mentally dedicate the goodness of our session today. We dedicate the goodness of this session to all suffering beings, that all beings are free from suffering, come to happiness, and then to Buddhahood. And coming to Buddhahood, may they emanate in all directions and benefit all sentient beings endlessly. We dedicate the goodness with this thought in mind. All right. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us for this week's Dharma Talk. We hope you enjoyed the podcast. If you did, please subscribe, rate, and review it on iTunes. To learn more about the Columbus Karma Teksum Choling or to donate to support our Dharma Talk series, please visit our website at columbusktc.org. The opening and closing music for the podcast is Tibetan Flute Song by Tamding Arts at tamdingarts.com. Please join us again next week for another Dharma Talk.